It's hard to find the time to read all of the best articles on Bitcoin and the crypto economy. So let me read them for you. This is a Crypto Economy Quick Read. What is up, guys? Welcome back to the Crypto Economy. I am your host, Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. And we are continuing through Bitcoin Sovereignty Through Mathematics, Knut von Holm's amazing work that we are reading the full audiobook for here on the show. This is part three, so there are two previous episodes to get you caught up to where we are in the book, so don't forget to go back and listen to those. But for now, we are jumping right into chapter five, Proof of Work. Zoom out of time for a while and imagine how the antlers of a magnificent moose buck evolved into being. The main purpose of big antlers in nature is believed to be a way for the buck to impress potential mates. They're somewhat akin to the feathers of a peacock, or the shroud of any male bird for that matter. The animal is trying to signal that it can thrive in its environment despite its enormous appendage. It's there to tell the potential mate that this specific specimen will bring her strong, healthy offspring. These are all evolutionary metaphors, of course. The animal itself is probably unaware of signaling anything. For such antlers to evolve into being, a whole lot of moose will have to die early, or at least not get a chance to reproduce over thousands of generations. In other words, a lot of resources need to be wasted. All of this for the animal to prove its value to potential spouses. Therefore, from the surviving moose's point of view, the aforementioned resources were sacrificed rather than wasted. The proof-of-work algorithm in Bitcoin does a similar thing. It enables miners to sacrifice a lot of electricity, a real-world resource, to find a certain number and thereby proving that they had to commit a lot of time and effort to do this. Time, by the way, is the scarcest of all resources. Because of all this, a Bitcoin miner is very reluctant to sell Bitcoins at a net loss. The electricity has already been used when the Bitcoins pop into existence, and the miner has no other means of getting his money back than by selling the Bitcoins for more than the cost of the electricity it took to produce them. This is assuming that the mining rig itself has already been paid for. Proof of work is a way of converting computing power into money, in a sense. Yes, these rigs consume a lot of energy, but the energy consumed correlates directly to the actual value of the created token. Any decrease in the energy expenditure would also lead to a decrease in the value of the token. Not necessarily the price, but the actual value. This is the main reason mining algorithms can't be less resource-consuming or more energy-efficient. Quote, wasting energy is the whole point. No waste, no proof of commitment. The fundamental principles of Bitcoin were set in stone in 2008, and block number zero, the so-called Genesis block, was mined in January 2009. In Bitcoin, a block of transactions is created every 10 minutes. In its first 4 years of existence, these blocks included a 50 Bitcoin block reward given to the miner who found the block. Every 4 years, this reward is halved so that the maximum number of Bitcoins that can ever be claimed can never exceed just short of 21 million. Every 2016 blocks, or roughly every 2 weeks, the difficulty of finding a new block is recalibrated so that a block will be found every 10 minutes on average. The value of this feature and the impact it has on coin issuance is often understated. It is one of the features of Bitcoin that separates it from gold and other assets in one of the most subtle yet most powerful ways. When the price of gold or silver or oil or any other asset goes up, producing that asset becomes more profitable and more resources are allocated to produce more of it faster. This in turn evens out the price as the total supply of said asset increases. Gold has been able to maintain or increase its value long term over time because of its high stock-to-flow ratio. Stock refers to the supply of an asset currently available on the market. Flow refers to the amount added to the stock per time unit. The bigger the stock in relation to the flow, the less of an impact on the total supply an increase in the price of a specific asset has. In Bitcoin, a price increase has virtually no impact at all on the coin issuance rate or flow, since the difficulty of finding the next block in the chain is constantly being optimized for a strict issuance schedule. No other asset has ever behaved like this, and we are yet to find out what impact its existence will have on the world economy. So how does one mine a block in the Bitcoin blockchain? In short, the mining process goes something like this. Every active node in the Bitcoin network stores a copy of the mempool, which contains all Bitcoin transactions that haven't been confirmed yet. The miner puts as many transactions as the block size allows into the block, usually selecting those with the highest fee first. He then adds a random number called a nonce and produces a hash of the entire thing using the SHA-256 hashing algorithm. A hashing algorithm turns data into a string of numbers. If the resulting hash begins with a specific number of zeros decided by the current difficulty of the network, the miner wins the block reward, collects all the fees, and gets to put the block on the blockchain. The beauty of the system is that it is trivial for the nodes in the network to verify the block so that no double spending can occur, but it's near impossible to forge a fake hash, since the probability of finding one that begins with as many zeros as the difficulty of the Bitcoin network demands is extremely low. To a layman's eye, a hash beginning with a bunch of zeros just looks like a random number. But a person who understands the mathematics behind it sees a different thing. The zeros act as proof of an enormous commitment to trying out different nonces and trying to find a perfect match. If you're able to understand these huge numbers, you quickly realize that this number must have been created by devoting computing power to doing just that, on an absolutely massive scale. The proof is in the zeros. If you compare just the hash rate of the top five so-called cryptocurrencies, it is obvious that Bitcoin is on a different level security-wise. From a hash rate to security perspective, the Ethereum blockchain is about 5 times as ineffective and the Litecoin blockchain about 10 times as ineffective as the Bitcoin blockchain at the time of this writing. Source: howmanycomps.com. This in addition to the obviously more centralized nature of these, quote, alternatives. Some of the futurists and doomsday prophets mentioned in Chapter 4 as the people most likely to warn us about the dangers of the impending artificial intelligence singularity believe that we already live in a simulated reality. The main argument for this world view is that since simulations and computer graphics seem to be getting better at an ever-accelerating rate, we can't really know if we already live in a simulation or not. To put it another way, we simply have no way of knowing if we live in the Matrix or if our perceived reality is all there is. A really mind-blowing counter-argument to this theory is that Bitcoin's proof-of-work algorithm would eventually slow down the simulation, since proof-of-work is verifiable and can't be simulated itself. Computing power would have to be sacrificed by some entity somewhere, regardless. One question remains, though. Can the inhabitants of a simulated reality actually feel or measure a slowdown of the very simulation they live in? Chapter 6. Scarcity. What makes a commodity scarce? What is scarcity in the first place? What other properties can be deduced from an object's scarcity? How are scarcity, energy, time, and value connected? Scarcity might seem easy to describe on the surface, but in reality, it's not. Not when you take infinity into account. Infinity is a concept that has puzzled the human mind for as long as it has been able to imagine it, if it ever has. It is a very abstract concept, and it's always linked to time, simply because even imagining an infinite number would take an infinite amount of time. If we truly live in an infinite universe, scarcity cannot exist. If something exists in an infinite universe, an infinite number of copies of this something must also exist, since the probability of this being true would also be infinite in an infinite universe. Therefore, scarcity must always be defined within a set framework. No frame, no scarcity. Think of it this way. The most expensive artwork ever sold at the time of writing was the Salvator Mundi, painted by Leonardo da Vinci. It's not even a particularly beautiful painting, so why the high price? Because da Vinci originals are scarce. A poster of the painting isn't expensive at all, but the original will cost you at least $450 million U.S. dollars. All because we agree to frame its scarcity around the notion that it is a Da Vinci original, of which under 20 exist today. Historically, scarcity has always been framed around real-world limits to the supply of a good. Most of the great thinkers of the Austrian School of Economics from the 20th century believed that the value of a monetary good arises from its scarcity, and that scarcity is always connected to the real-world availability of that good. Most of them believed that a gold standard would be the hardest form of money that we would ever see, and the closest thing to an absolutely scarce resource as we would ever know. In the late 90s, the cryptographers that laid the groundwork for what would become Bitcoin reimagined scarcity as anything with an unforgeable costliness. This mindset is key to understanding the connection between scarcity and value. Anything can be viewed as scarce if it's sufficiently hard to produce and hard to fake the production cost of. In other words, easy to verify the validity of. The zeros in the beginning of a hashed Bitcoin block are the proof of work that proves that the created coins in the block were costly to produce. People who promote the idea that the mining algorithm used to produce Bitcoin could be more environmentally friendly or streamlined are either deliberately lying or missing the point. The energy expenditure is the very thing that gives the token its value, because it provides proof to the network that enough computing power was sacrificed in order to keep the network sufficiently decentralized and thus resistant to change. Easy to verify is the flip side of the unforgeable costliness coin. The validity of a Bitcoin block is very easy to verify, since all you need to do is look at the hash of it, make sure the block is part of the strongest chain, and that it conforms to all consensus rules. In order to check that a gold bar is real or not, you probably need to trust a third party. Fiat money often comes with a plethora of water stamps, holograms, and metal stripes, so in a sense, they're hard to forge. What you cannot know about a fiat currency at any given moment, though, is how much of it there is in circulation. What you do know is that they're not scarce. Bitcoin provides us with absolute scarcity for the first time in human history. It is a remarkable breakthrough. Even though you can't make jewelry or anything else out of Bitcoins, their total supply is fixed. After the year 2140, after the last Bitcoin has been mined, the total amount of Bitcoins in circulation can only go down. This limited supply is what the gold standards of the past were there for in the first place. Bitcoin supply is much more limited than that of gold, however, since they will be lost as time goes by. Since the supply is so limited, it doesn't matter what the current demand is. The potential upside to its value is literally limitless due to this relationship between supply and demand. The quote, backing that other currencies have is only there to ensure people that the currency will keep its value over time, and the only way of ensuring this is to limit the supply. Bitcoin does this better than any other thing before it. Leonardo da Vinci's original paintings are extremely valuable because of Leonardo's brand name and the fact that there's only about 13 of them left. One day, there will be less than one left. The same is true for Bitcoin. Scarcity on the internet was long believed to be an impossible invention, and it took a multi-talented genius, such as Satoshi Nakamoto, to figure out all the different parts that make Bitcoin so much more than the sum of them. His disappearance from the project was one such part, maybe the most important one. The thing about computerized scarcity is that it was a one-time invention. Once it was invented, the invention could not be recreated. That's just the nature of data. Computers are designed to be able to replicate any data set any number of times. This is true for every piece of code there is, and digital scarcity needed to be framed somehow to work. Bitcoin's consensus rules provided such a frame. Bitcoin certainly seems to provide true digital scarcity, and if the game theoretical theories that it builds on are correct, its promise of an ever-increasing value will be a self-fulfilling prophecy. In 2018, the inflation rate of the Venezuelan Bolivar was a staggering 80,000%. Hugo Chavez and his successor Nicolas Maduro effectively killed the Venezuelan economy with socialism. It has happened before, and sadly, it is likely to happen again. The main problem with socialism is not that people aren't incentivized to work in socialist countries. On the contrary, hungry people under the threat of violence tend to work harder than most. The problem with state-owned production is that there is no free market price mechanism to reflect the true demand for goods, and therefore no way of knowing how much supply the state should produce. Everything is in constant surplus or shortage, often the latter, as the empty supermarket shelves in Venezuela depressingly attest. Chavez and Maduro attempted to rescue the country's economy by printing more money, which simply does not work. Their true motives for printing money are, of course, questionable given that it depreciated the value of Bolivar bills to less than that of toilet paper. As mentioned in earlier chapters, inflation is the greatest hidden threat to themselves that humans have ever created. A few hundred years ago, the Catholic Church held the lion's share of political power throughout Europe. Today, power mostly resides with nation-states in collusion with multinational corporations. The separation of church and state triggered the migration of power from the former to the latter, emancipating many citizens in the process. Still, places like Venezuela are sad proof that, quote, the people are still not in power in many self-proclaimed democracies, if in any, for that matter. Another separation will have to take place first, the separation of money and state. We, the people of planet Earth, now have the means at our disposal for this separation to take place. Whether we use them or not will determine how emancipated and independent our children can and will be in the future. Chapter 7. Holding On. In the old days, we Scandinavians had to save in order to prepare for the long winter. We chopped wood and salted meat in order to survive. In our current age of consumerism, however, we've forgotten all that, and we pilgrim to the shopping malls as much as everyone else. No one seems to even have a savings account anymore. Interest rates are low, and we're told to borrow and spend as much as we can. We're bombarded with advertising for loans, mortgages, and financial services on a daily basis. Why? Because of our inability to understand the nature of money and its mechanics. Inflation is the underlying force that makes us squander rather than save. Inflation hinders us from reaping the fruits of our labor whenever we so think fit, and it makes that very fruit rot. Bitcoin reverses the rotting process and provides us with a means of transporting the value of our labor not only through space, but also through time. The Stanford Marshmallow Experiments was a series of studies on delayed gratification conducted in the late 1960s and early 1970s. In the experiments, children were given a marshmallow or a cookie and were told that they would receive an additional one if they could control their urges and not touch the first one for 15 minutes. Follow-up studies found that the kids that were able to resist the temptation of the first cookie tended to score better on SAT tests and have lower BMIs and higher incomes than their less disciplined counterparts. Investing in your future self, in other words, resisting present temptation by delaying gratification, is the most effective skill you can cultivate for a brighter future. You reap what you sow. This can be described as having a low time preference. Having a low time preference is a fundamental factor in the economic success of any human endeavor. Not trying to catch fish with your hands for a couple of days in order to construct a rod or net when on a deserted island might make you hungry during those sacrificed days, but will provide a better chance of catching fish in the future. Likewise, learning new skills now might lead to a higher salary in the future. Unfortunately, our current monetary system distorts our perceptions and incentives and favors those with higher time preference, those that spend rather than save. We're at a different point in history than the above-mentioned marooned fishermen. Give a man a fish and feed him for a day. Teach a man to fish and feed him for a lifetime, the saying goes. The ultimate goal should be to teach mankind to teach itself how to fish. What our current paradigm endorses is give a man enough distractions and he will stop thinking about finding better ways to support his loved ones and will succumb to whatever narrative you fill his head with to make him work for you through taxes and inflation instead of for himself. In Bitcoin, people with a low time preference win. If you can resist the urge to sell, you will be rewarded in the future. The Bitcoin community refers to not selling as hodling, which originated when a BitcoinTalk.org forumer named Game Kyuubi misspelled the word holding in a now-famous post titled, "I am hodling." The post became one of the Bitcoin community's most prominent memes and a battle cry to resist the urge to sell during bear markets. Bitcoiners who have decided to never sell most or all of their holdings are referred to as hodlers of last resort. This term is not to be confused with the central banking term lender of last resort. The yearly highs in the price of Bitcoin are arguably less interesting than the yearly lows, which are practically decided by these hodlers of last resort. Considering its limited supply, all that Bitcoin needs to keep rising in price over the medium and long term are these people. Adoption and other metrics of measuring the success of Bitcoin are all dwarfed by the currency's remarkable rise in value since its inception. The price has multiplied upward by 10 approximately every 3 years. The best guarantee that we have that it will keep doing this is Bitcoin's limited supply combined with the hodlers of last resort. In the Bitcoin space, and even more so in the cryptocurrency space on the whole, there's a lot of talk about usage and adoption. We're shown metrics of trading volumes and merchant acceptance, and we're led to believe that these correlate with the short and long-term value in one way or another. While there may be some truth in some of these theories, The most basic function of a deflationary asset is overlooked and rarely mentioned. The elephant in the room, so to speak. The best use for a commodity as scarce as Bitcoin is not to spend it or even to trade it, but to save it and hold it for as long as you can. By doing so, you limit the number of coins in circulation. The more people that do this, the harder it will be to come by and the higher its price will be. Nothing on earth is as scarce as Bitcoin. Nothing is as irreplicable, as immutable, and at the same time as portable as Bitcoin. Its unique history and resistance to change has already proven this over and over. Its absolute scarcity is what gives Bitcoin its value, and ironically enough, this seems to be the hardest thing for people to understand about it. What if everyone in the network became a hodler and decided to never sell? Wouldn't the network just slowly come to a halt? Not at all. Everyone has a price. Few would resist selling some of their bitcoins if it could buy them a small city. There are price levels for each hodler where reallocating financially may be a wise thing to do. A bitcoin is also very divisible. The smallest unit, Satoshi, sometimes referred to as a sat, is 1/100,000,000th of a bitcoin. Even smaller units are made possible with the introduction of the Lightning Network, albeit not in the actual Bitcoin blockchain. Together, this enables Bitcoins to be highly saleable, even at astronomical price levels. All right, I really need a break right here. We still have a bit left in this chapter to finish up, so let's just hit our sponsor real quick. I'm going to grab a drink, and then we'll jump back in. What not having sound money has done to us is simply unfathomable. Imagine every person on earth knowing that every transaction they'll ever make will have a real impact on their future prosperity. We're so used to inflationary currencies that most people don't even realize why sound money is important. We're so used to having a large cut of our income silently taken away from us that we don't even realize how much of our day we spent working for someone else. Wars are funded by inflation. Try to imagine how many man hours were put in by people that didn't realize they were actually working for a war machine, funded by a corrupt currency during World War II. Every time you use a fiat currency, you legitimize counterfeiting. Every time you use Bitcoin, you promote sound money. In fact, every time you don't use your Bitcoins but save them instead, you promote sound money. Because sound money increases in value when the total number of coins in circulation is limited. It all sounds a bit magic and far-fetched, doesn't it? Increased value over time, no matter what happens? Well, that is why many of us so-called Bitcoin maximalists are so excited that we put our career at risk for this technology. Once you realize what Bitcoin is and what it will do for the world, there is no way of unrealizing it. It really is mind-blowing. At the beginning of Time That Actually Is Money, in other words around 2009, Bitcoin was mostly considered a toy for the cypherpunk movement. As its price started to grow rapidly, a small group of early investors became very wealthy, which in turn spawned a media hype around the phenomenon. The mainstream media remained largely skeptical, portraying Bitcoin as a pyramid scheme, a tulip craze, or a bubble at best. Most journalists simply couldn't understand how an asset seemingly created out of thin air could have any long-term relevance. Some were frustrated because they thought they'd missed the train. Many still do. In a world where companies like Google, Facebook, and Amazon can rise from zero to world dominance in a decade, people tried to find the next big thing, the next Bitcoin. This attracted charlatans and scammers to the field, who launched hundreds of altcoins claiming to someday be technically superior, faster, or more privacy-focused. What the snake oil salespeople omitted were the crucial facts. Their new coins and tokens were not decentralized, and therefore neither immutable nor censorship-resistant, did not have a fair distribution, and so on. What most people still don't get is that if Bitcoin doesn't work, nothing will. This is humanity's best shot at sound money. It is also, very likely, our only shot at it. Many venture capital firms, hedge funds, and retail investors were bamboozled by the buzzword frenzy and invested great sums in these quack tokens. This generated confusion in the market as many altcoins increased dramatically in price at an even higher rate than Bitcoin. Due to human nature and a lack of understanding basic monetary economics, the bubble grew bigger and bigger until it inevitably popped and wiped out most of the useless alternative cryptocurrencies. Bitcoin experienced ups and downs as well, but they were less volatile. Bitcoin bottomed at levels well above the beginning of the previous bull run and then resumed rising just as it has done several times before. The victims of the altcoin craze will take note of this. They will learn the hard way what separates the original from the copycat. They will see the undisputable superiority of sound money. It's just a matter of time. Time, which is money. Every time the people of Venezuela, Turkey, Argentina, or Zimbabwe are screwed over by their respective central banking authorities and turn to Bitcoin to preserve their savings or income from rampant inflation, the world becomes more aware of Bitcoin as a store of value. In comparison to the Venezuelan Bolivar, there was no crash in Bitcoin at all. There's also a good chance the really big players will accumulate aggressively during the next bull market, given that Bitcoin, for the moment, still represents a very small allocation of institutional and hedge fund investment. Considering what will happen when institutional investors and a growing number of larger nations start to see Bitcoin's potentially limitless upside, at this point, central banks will start to accumulate Bitcoins in an attempt to keep up with reality. This will legitimize the technology even further. It is still unclear when this will all play out. When it does, however, it will be the largest transfer of wealth from one medium to another in human history. Early investors, many of which are technically competent, will become financially independent and therefore able to contribute to the ecosystem full-time. More and more people will demand payment in Bitcoin for its ability to store value. Remember that the next block reward halving is just around the corner, and that Bitcoin will have an even greater stock-to-flow ratio than gold in just a few years. After the halving in 2020, Bitcoin will have a supply inflation rate of approximately 1.8%, which is lower than the U.S. Federal Reserve's target 2% price inflation rate. It is important to remember that Bitcoin is still an experiment. Should the experiment work, however, hyper-Bitcoinization is just a matter of time. The implications of giving everyone on Earth the ability to rot-proof the fruit of their labor and transport its value through time are hard to overstate. The closest thing we've had to it historically is gold, but gold is not very divisible and not very easy for the general public to get their hands on. More importantly, gold is not absolutely scarce. No one knows how much of it there is left buried in the Earth's crust. Investing in real estate has also been seen as a good store of value throughout the ages, but real estate needs a lot of maintenance and is not cheap to hold on to. Real estate is also relatively easy to confiscate in the event of political collapse. Bitcoin provides us with the potential ability to store any amount in our heads and pass it down through generations without anyone ever knowing we had it in the first place. It effectively endows each individual with the power possessed by the feudal kings to turn people into knights. Any Bitcoiner can now dub any no-coiner into a fully fledged, time-proof Bitcoiner. Chapter 8. Changing the Rules. All right, now let's stop there and we will start back with Chapter 8 tomorrow. Again, this is part three of Sovereignty Through Mathematics by Knuts von Holm. And there's a lot to break down in this section. So much great stuff to cover, so let's go ahead and jump into it. The concept of proof of work, that's what we start with here with chapter five, is on proof of work, right? It is something that you see in nature all the time, and it is something that you see in human society quite a bit as well. Really, to some degree, a reputation system is a form of proof of work. It's that you have this history that I can in some way verify to certain degrees of assurances and integrity. Like there can obviously be fake proof of work. That's why it's not proof. It's kind of an inclination of work. Like my podcast is proof of work. I say, at the beginning of my show, and it's kind of a joke, I'm the guy who's read more about Bitcoin than anybody else but I am the only, I have no doubt in my mind that I have the largest library of proof of work for how much I have read. Like everybody else is just like, oh, well, I read Ethics of Money Production, and I read Hayek, and I read Nick Carter and Szabo and all this stuff. But how do you know? You don't have to trust me when I say it. You can look at all the stuff I've read in audio. That's a form of proof of work. And then we've got the moose as an example, which is really cool where we see this actually in nature, that a moose has like massive antlers, and it is a way to show, just like the peacock tail, is that like I am such a badass that even with this massive handicap, that's actually what it's referred to as a it's the handicap principle, and it's a way of signaling reliably to another mate that that can't be cheated. It's unforgeable costliness. Like, you are not going to make it to reproductive age and adulthood if you aren't a badass when you're carrying around a 20-foot tail that's bright as shit that every predator for 2 miles can see you coming. That serves the role of proof of work. That's what it is. Obviously suggests that, if you pick me, you don't have to know all of the experiences that I have had. You don't have to know, you don't have to really guess how strong I am. You can know because I'm carrying around this big obnoxious thing that I have to be at least a certain amount strong and healthy and, able to fight in order to actually survive in the wild. But obviously, like he says, is like none of this is all metaphorical. Like, this is evolution that is creating these tendencies to like or dislike these things based on the fact that those characteristics that tend to survive tend to survive. There are no female peacocks doing the analysis in their head that, oh, he's got such a huge and beautiful tail, obviously, he's super strong. It's just, evolution encourages them to like the large, colorful tail because their offspring are more likely to survive by picking them. Another really great example, which I think is actually, it was a Twitter thread by Ben Kaufman. I think I might have the wrong person because we've read a couple of articles by him. I can't remember exactly who it was, but just talking about, and it's an idea that many have thrown out actually, but that the pyramids are a great example of proof of work. That they are so, like, we know insanely little, so little about their civilization, but the one thing we do know is that it was a great civilization. Because those pyramids have stood the test of time. They were a proof of work that they had unbelievable amounts of capital and technology in order to produce these magnificent structures that could survive for millennia after millennia. It's just utterly insane. And one thing that I didn't actually know until just a couple of years ago, when I was tackling this whole proof of work thing in the early days, was that there was actually a layer of limestone, which you can actually see just at the top of the larger of the pyramids. There was a layer of limestone covering the entire thing. That what you're actually seeing is the underneath foundation or the base of the pyramid, and it was actually originally covered with polished limestone. So the thing would actually have looked like a diamond shining on the horizon. That is insane that what we still have, even after millennia and all of that has, you know, basically weathered away, that we still have these magnificent structures as veritable proof of how incredible their civilization likely was. And no one can really contest that because, like, people it's like, oh, well, their civilization was terrible. I can literally point at the pyramids and be like, nuh-uh. They had something going for them. And in a very similar way, Bitcoin's proof of work is a way of proving the integrity of the blockchain and a way to achieve consensus on what the rules of that chain are. And by doing so, it enforces and makes possible digital scarcity. The idea of Szabo's unforgeable costliness, in his example, the cypherpunks in the 90s who basically readjusted to understand scarcity as the principle of unforgeable costliness, because everything that has scarcity is specifically because it is unforgeably costly. There's simply no way to make gold outside of expending a ton of energy to either go find it or dig it up, or by some other method that inevitably is going to be just as costly or more so, like, you know, irradiating lead or whatever, or mercury or whatever it is. And that's one of those incredibly unique things about Bitcoin. I mean, it is the thing. Just like Knut says in this book, is that it is literally the invention of Bitcoin is digital scarcity. And also not only just digital scarcity, but in a digital way created scarcity that's more scarce than anything that's physical. It created an algorithm, the difficulty adjustment essentially, to create a way to make its scarcity absolute, that its supply schedule is 100% set in stone, and it doesn't matter how many resources are chasing it. You know, if you have 20 times as many people mining for gold as you did yesterday, well, then you're going to find a lot more gold per day than you did yesterday. If you start expending growth, just giant amounts of resources in order to obtain gold, you're going to heavily increase the flow of it. You can't do that with Bitcoin. In fact, that's technically not true. You can do that for 2016 blocks before you are completely cut off from being able to do it anymore. And no matter what you do, it averages out to the same inflation schedule over a long enough time period so that it was meaningless. And it does not matter how many computers you throw at it. It does not matter how many ASICs you have. The supply schedule adjusts to the market, either increasing or decreasing the amount of resources going to creating new Bitcoin. And that is a fascinating concept. And just like he says, is that there is no way, there's literally no way to know, because we have no perfect allegory to this. We have no experiment that has created anything so scarce, neither in money nor land nor anything. Really, time is the only thing, as he says, that is truly as scarce as Bitcoin. So we don't know what this is going to be like. You know, after 10, 20 years of this, when this really becomes the most scarce asset to have ever existed, we don't have the slightest clue what it will really look like. We have a lot of great theories, and because Austrian theory has essentially stayed in line so far and basically predicted many of the things that you know, the Austrian school would have led us to believe would occur, then we have some degree of assurances that we are correct in our economic thinking, because Bitcoin is actually succeeding where you know, Keynesian theory basically says Bitcoin is doomed to die and it should have just never have gotten off the ground, period. So because of that, this is an experiment in codifying Austrian economics theory. So I really think a lot of the fundamental ideas behind the Austrian economic theory are either proven right or wrong with the failure or success of Bitcoin's monetary policy. Now, Bitcoin getting a bug and collapsing and dying will have no effect. It will have no bearing on whether or not the theory was right or not, because that would just mean that Bitcoin no longer was held to the Austrian economic, like the monetary schedule that it was supposed to. But, you know, just for any listeners who are not familiar with it, just to kind of explain what proof of work is, just from a technical standpoint, just because it's a fascinating concept on its face, not only like the impact it has and what it can be used for in the context of something like Bitcoin, but also just like what it is, why it is proof, essentially, that somebody has done an enormous amount of work. So I use the example of a hash is like a fingerprint of data, right? So like if I have like a page of a book and then I produce a hash from that, what I've basically done is I've used a SHA-256 algorithm, which is, you know, sounds like craziness, but it literally is just a math problem that I can't know the outcome of the math without doing it and just seeing it. It's like a provably random algorithm, and it produces what is kind of like a really long receipt number, so to speak. And it's entirely dependent, because it's a completely random algorithm, it's entirely dependent on the information on that page. So if I change anything, let's say I've got a page with like 1,000 words on it, if I change a single space in that and hash it again, the new hash will look absolutely nothing like the old hash, because the page is no longer the same. And because it's random, it won't like sort of look like it, even though the page is like 99.999% the same information. That's irrelevant. It doesn't matter whether it's 99.999% or 95% or 2%. The hashes will look and will have absolutely zero similarity whatsoever. That's why you have to check the hash. You actually have to validate it against the information. But because it's random, we have no idea what it's going to look like, right? We don't know until we actually hash it. So if somebody says, make a hash of this page that that has 10 zeros at the front of it, well, I hash it one time and now it's, you know, it's got no zeros in it. And I'm like, shit, well, I got to do it again. But how do I change it? I need to change the data arbitrarily in such a way that it doesn't actually change what's on the page. And, but it gives me a different hash. Well, then I'll put at the end of it, parenthesis one. That's my nonce. Nonce is a number used only once. That's what that stands for. So I'm just going to put a one at the end of the page. All the other data is exactly the same, but I'm just going to throw this extra little thing on it, because I can just keep changing this and it will give me a new hash. So I hash again with a number one at the end. And now the page produces a hash with a single zero at the front of the hash. I'm like, oh, I'm getting close. And then I do it again. Now I change it to two. And now there's no zeros again. Oh, shit. So I just keep doing it over and over and over again. And then when I count up to 1,573,642,150, boom, I've got a hash with 10 zeros. But I had to, because there's no shortcut to this process, because the outcome is completely random and I must do the work to know what the hash is going to be. I had to check all of those. And the fact that my hash is valid with my number, you know, 1 billion whatever, and the page that I've got it tacked at the end of, everybody else can know, no questions asked, that the probability of me finding that after one hash attempt is like 1 to 2 billionth or something like that. So if I have produced that hash, that is proof of work. They know that I ran a computer hot as shit, blowing air and making noise in my room or in my server farm or wherever it is for a very, very long time before I found that hash, that valid hash with 10 zeros at the front. That is what proof of work is. And it is not a waste. It is the only reason we can know that when someone has extended the consensus, has extended the blockchain within the consensus rules, that it is a valid, that it is valid Bitcoin, that there is an unforgeable costliness to the altering of who the owner of a Bitcoin is, that there is an unforgeable costliness to the issuance of new Bitcoin into the system. It is a digital thing that as long as we validate it against the consensus rules, and those hashes are a critical part of the consensus rules, as long as we validate it, we know no one can fake Bitcoin. If we don't validate it, we don't know shit. But if we do, we have the highest degree of assurance that we could possibly have that this is real Bitcoin. And it's a fascinating idea that this, we've never had anything like this in the digital realm. And the fact that everybody just like immediately ran out and to like copy it and make a new shit token for whatever purpose they thought they could come up with. The beauty of doing, finding this innovation in the digital realm is that we can now apply it to the most critical good in the entire economy, which is money. No matter what the market for, you know, e-cigarettes is, money is that plus every other good. Whatever the market for computer hardware is, money is e-cigarettes plus computer hardware plus every other market. Money is the half of all markets that institute exchange and trade. So money is the most critical good. If there is a corruption or a fault in the good we are using as money, it manipulates and destroys the ability to communicate value in every other market there is. And it doesn't matter if it's small, it causes a small problem versus a big problem. But no matter what, it's an inability to communicate value properly. The better and more secure and more scarce the good is that we use as money, the less corruptible those value measurements are. They can still be corrupted. They will be corrupted when somebody steals because they will not treat that money the same as money that they earned. It will still be corrupted because, you know, people will act in violence against each other. Everything that is not an actual value measurement of someone's immediate use, everything that like manipulates that, which includes violence and theft, those things are manipulations of the value of money, actually. They're just so minor in the grand scheme of things that we don't see them. It's just a natural part of having to put up with those individual, those micro cheatings of the system. But you'd never, that's why we would never use a good that could be easily counterfeited, because it collapses in no time. It just no longer becomes a useful monetary good, because money is about instituting a way to create honest trade and value measurement between people. Most importantly, people who may have nothing else in common, people who might not be able to properly communicate or translate their reputations, or to they don't really know anybody in their family. They don't know if they can trust these other people. It is a way to bridge against people specifically who do not trust each other. That is the critical thing that money does. Because outside of Dunbar's number, the 150, which is the number of relationships any human can hold in their head at one time, essentially, the limit by outside of which we are no longer able to really cooperate, which is why tribes and villages for thousands of years basically did not scale past, you know, 100 to 200 members. At least not before there was some sort of a war or a huge rift in the communities, because they would isolate into, you know, two different halves and then break apart, and they'd have to create again, you know, two villages, two tribes, that kind of thing. So money is the gap between that, so that rather than trying to figure out how, who's this, what this guy's reputation is, or whether my sister knows the friend who knows the cousin who knows this guy that I'm about to trade with, well, as long as I can trust the good that he is giving me, as long as I can trust the money, and I know that that tribe or that other person or whoever it is has no control over the value of the money, that is an independent asset, well, we can do business because we have common ground in the money. We have a common form of value that we both understand, and everything else can be dealt with because we have that common medium. It's like having a language of value. I can't stress that enough. That's why I've talked about it in all three episodes so far, where we've talked about sovereignty through mathematics. Bitcoin and money are languages. And the whole idea is that we all share the same one. And we would only share the one that can scale trust to billions of people. And the only way to scale trust to billions of people is to make it incredibly easy and low cost to validate it. Validate it without any uncertainty whatsoever, with the highest assurances ever possible that we know 100% this is actual Bitcoin. This is the one with the most proof of work. This is the one that is valid all the way back to the Genesis block. That there has never been anything in this system that has ever been created, no coins whatsoever, that do not follow the consensus rules. When people say Bitcoin can't scale, they don't realize why, how Bitcoin needs to scale. Bitcoin scales better than everything else when it comes to social scalability, which is one of the most important aspects of a monetary good. Szabo. Nick Szabo has an incredible piece on this called Money, Blockchains, and Social Scalability. It's one of my favorite reads in this, and I highly recommend it. It's all about that concept and how you scale trust between different groups of people or different societies, and he refers to that as social scalability, and it is the one thing that Bitcoin has due to its independence, decentralization, and integrity, which are all, you know, really dependent on each other. They're really kind of the same thing, but because of that, it is the most socially scalable digital ledger that has ever existed. And part of that is in the combination of all of these things, of the ease and widespread validation, the incredible amounts of proof of work that are put on, like Amber, on the blockchain to make it more and more difficult to edit, to prove the incredible cost to actually adjust, to make any changes whatsoever to this ledger, while all of the validating full nodes will reject any sort of invalid, any outside of the consensus rules edit, regardless of how much somebody spent on it. You know, you can do proof of work all day and all night for, you know, 100 years if you wanted to, and try to roll back the chain 100 blocks. But if you produce a block that gives you 70 bitcoins, nobody, no fully validating node is going to accept it, no matter how much proof of work is on it. So all of these things together are what ensure the integrity of that, which allows that incredible social scalability, which makes Bitcoin a global asset, a powerful global asset that can continue to hold value in the face of nation states, in the face of massive corporations, adversaries of enormous size. And that's a huge part of keeping the block size small. That's another one of those critical pieces of the puzzle as to why the block size must be small, because we need as little information as possible to validate so that this thing runs over Tor, so that this thing can squeeze through any firewall anywhere on the planet. The Great Firewall of China cannot stop Bitcoin blocks from getting into the country. Why? Because we've got satellites broadcasting out the blocks that the Great Firewall has no control over whatsoever. We have our blocks are small enough that they can run over Tor. And even though China has tried desperately on so many occasions to keep Tor from being able to be accessible inside of China, every single time, in a matter of even where they have like cut off 80 or 90% of the traffic, something is always leaking through. And inevitably, the developers make adjustments or account for it. And the valve on all that information through the Tor network just opens right back up as soon as people start upgrading their system. So Bitcoin is the only asset that I know of in the cryptocurrency space that I think could actually stand up to that. If China tried to keep it out of their country, there'd be blocks being broadcasted through low-band radio across the border. There'd be blocks coming in through satellite. There'd be blocks squeezing in through Tor. And BSV would be cut off immediately. You can't run that over Tor. You can't run that over low-band radio or satellite. 128 megabyte blocks or gigameg blocks, whatever the hell they want to have. You'll never be able to maintain consensus. You will simply be trusting someone else to quote-unquote mint your coins for you. And you'll never have any idea whether or not the inflation schedule is being adhered to or not. And if, you know, a couple of the major miners in the world want to change the inflation rate because, you know, their salaries are getting cut, well, as long as everybody else is running SPV, no problem. Let's just upgrade. You know, and on that note, too, like countries like Venezuela and Argentina and Zimbabwe, all of these countries that are having currency crises and just seeing massive amounts of inflation, you get... like big blockers are constantly talking about how like, oh, well, they need to use it for coffee payments and they need to use it for this, that, or the other. And that is not really, that's not the major problem. The Bolivar actually still works if you exchange Bolivar for Bitcoin immediately when you sell it or immediately when you are spending that Bolivar somewhere. And that's what a lot of the people in Venezuela do. They don't use it as a means of payment. They use it to store their capital. What you need to get out of poverty is to accumulate capital over time. You need to be able to put away $2 and for it to still be $2 in a week. And you need to keep adding to it. It is capital accumulation that ends poverty. And if everybody can buy Bitcoin and store it away, if every business can keep their the amount of funds that they need for the next purchasing of a grocery, restock their shelves, can keep it in Bitcoin during that time. It's the time that kills the value of the Bolivar. Inflation is a rate of value loss across time. If we're using it in 10 seconds, well, then it's not a problem. But if we're using it in 2 weeks, it no longer has the same value. It's the inability to store it for later that is being destroyed with these currencies and the corruption of these national monies. And that is what Bitcoin can solve. The ability to accumulate and store capital over time to get yourself out of poverty. And it doesn't mean that you should be able to spend it or need to be able to spend it at every merchant. That is a means of payment, not a money. These are not necessarily the same things. Often they are, but not necessarily. In many cases, they are not. And that's why hodling, which is chapter 7? Yeah, holding on. The hodlers, whatever, however you want to say that shit. I said hodl for a really long time, but I didn't like that because it's hold. It's a misspelling of hold. So it should be hodlers, right? I don't know. I'm curious what y'all think. It reminds me of GIF or GIF. Like I feel like GIF is the only thing that makes sense. It's graphical interface. So G-I-F, GIF, graphic. Don't at me about that. I'm not going to argue with you. but yeah, so that's what leads to hodling, because that is the value, to have an asset that is entirely independent. It's apolitical. It is independent of every jurisdiction in the world. It is independent of every corporation or anything. If you are holding it and you are the rightful owner per the Bitcoin blockchain, well, there is no one in the world who can contest that. And trying to get rid of that quickly is just not using it for what it's amazingly good at. Yes, because your ownership is undeniable, it is also censorship resistant. Yes, because your ownership is undeniable, no one can fake it or counterfeit those coins. The supply is locked. That is a part of how you know that your ownership is undeniable, because not only can nobody else contest your signature, but nobody else can contest exactly how much of the Bitcoin you have in relation to the total supply. There's no way to fake those coins. So the ability to use this as cash, to use it at a merchant without having to ask anybody's permission, is a consequence of the ease of verification, of the decentralized nature and ability to prove the amount of work it would take, to prove the amount of energy expenditure it would take to break the force field around your ownership. Now, if you're only one or two blocks deep, you don't have a very big force field around your ownership. It's actually with time that Bitcoin makes your ownership stronger and stronger and stronger with blocks added to the end of it, which is why I think the payments problem is just something we solve with a sidechain. It's just something we solve with Lightning Network or an additional layer. Because to compromise the core, to compromise the one utility Bitcoin has, the one thing that makes it cash, that makes it unbelievably powerful, and a digital thing that is actually scarce, makes no sense. Because then you're back to, you've just got payments in something that you're trusting someone else to keep secure and uncorrupted for you. And I don't believe in that. I run a full node, no questions asked. I know whether or not my Bitcoin is real because I validate. You know, I want to solve the coffee buying problem. I want a decentralized and secure way for to have everyday commerce in Bitcoin, in a secure, fungible, private, which, you know, Bitcoin isn't really, but I hope that we see on sidechains and Lightning and all these technologies to continue to develop for additional privacy, because I think that's a top concern, and it was one of the original visions of the cypherpunks. I think that's where Bitcoin fails more than anything else, but it's a trade-off. I think the bigger problem to solve is the central banking problem, is the idea of an asset that cannot be manipulated. The $100 trillion problem here is state money. Is the inflation of the monetary supply for the political elite, for the rich, for the Cantillon effect to benefit the financial sector, to bloat and corrupt and the moral infect with a moral hazard of society by the closer you are to the money printing machine, to create an unbelievable unfairness as to who has the ability to move and has access to capital? That is the most critical problem that we could solve. And if we have to give up, if I have to give up the fact that I can no longer buy coffee with Bitcoin because there's just no way to do it without incredibly high fees, I'm okay with that. If we are shutting the book, if we are putting inflation of the monetary supply, the corruption of money for political gain into the history books, and we are closing that book forever, I don't give a shit what I use to buy my coffee. Because that is the problem that causes ungodly amounts of pain in this world. Pain and suffering that cannot be calculated. He says the consequences of socialism and collectivism are unfathomable. It is literally true. We're talking about an entire country's worth of people starving because of shit monetary policy. I mean, we are witnessing one of the greatest refugee crises in the history of the world. Because of the corruption of the monetary supply, because of the wars, the endless wars that are being propped up with hundreds of thousands, millions of deaths across the Middle East, of American lives, of capital controls, from capital controls and starving populations, keeping resources from getting to innocent people in countries because we're pissed at what their politicians are doing. It is literally one of the greatest evils of the modern world. And I want to solve that. We can sort out cheap payments later. I don't even think we'll need to. Lightning is amazing. I mean, it's still got plenty of drawbacks. It is not ready for, you know, the mainstream yet. But I think there are a thousand different solutions to the payments problem, and there is one solution to the money problem, and that is Bitcoin. So let's close with that. So thank you guys so much for listening. Do not forget to follow our author of this amazing piece, Knuts van Holm, and I will have the link. I'll tag him in Twitter. Definitely follow him and give him a shout out. Thank him for making this book available for free on this show, because it really is awesome, and I've super enjoyed reading through this piece and commentating on it and having it available to you guys. I hope you guys are enjoying it as much as I am. So we will continue through this tomorrow and Friday. We probably have some pretty long episodes because today was 3 chapters, and I think I'm going to have to do 3 chapters again tomorrow and Friday. So they'll be a little bit longer, but I'm going to try to stick to it. I'm going to try to get it done this week. It looks like I'm going to be on Hotep Jesus' show debating Bitcoin versus BSV, following up Peter McCormick's and Shinobi's argument with Kurt and Connor or whoever. So wish me luck up there. I don't know if it's a good idea, but Hotep Jesus entertains me, and to me, it seems like he's genuinely trying to learn about it. So I can't help but think that I could enlighten him a little bit. I think I'll do a good job, but who knows? Maybe I suck at debating. We'll see. But don't forget to check that out, and follow me on Twitter at TheCryptoEconomy. And if you want to support the show, don't forget you can become a patron at patreon.com/TheCryptoEconomy. Just a tiny amount of money makes a world of difference and helps to keep this show alive so I can keep making audio of all of these works, of the articles, of the books, of some of these research papers and stuff, and keep explaining and teaching this stuff to everybody so that you know, people aren't in the dark in this space. There's so much misinformation, and it's so difficult to sort the signal from the noise. I like to think that that is what I'm doing with this show. And if you want to support me, please consider becoming a patron. And you'll also get in with our Telegram group so that you can hang out and chat with all the rest of the CryptoEconomy crew. Yeah, if you can't do that, well, there is one very easy way to support this show. And I end it the same every single day. Share it out with everybody you know in the Bitcoin and CryptoEconomy space. And, you know, everybody else too. Tell your mom, tell your brother and your friend and your sister and your cousins, and tell everybody about this show. Because if they want to learn about Bitcoin, this is where they're going to get it all. All right, guys. Thank you so much for listening. I am Guy Swan. And until next time, take it easy, guys.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.